Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday. It's the 12th of January. Very, very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning. It's a rainy Friday. Getting rid of a lot of the snow, though. We're getting washed off, if you will.
A lot of litter under that.
Lot of litter, a lot of stuff. So, but my car looks better. I don't know about yours. It just looks a little nicer, cleaner, a little bit cleaner. Well, good morning. Welcome. And you know what? We have a lot to talk about today. And I think I can speak for all of us when I say we never thought we would have to talk about this on our radio program, but there you go. It's the gift that keeps on giving, I guess. So we'll certainly get into that in just a moment. Let me introduce the panel to you. We have Rich Honan here. He is a corporate attorney. He's our good friend, and we are delighted to hello, the train's coming in. Good morning, Rich. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Good. It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much for coming in.
Great to be here. I will try and stay in tune with the vocabulary admonishments of the management.
Yes. Yes. Do not say the word.
It's going to be hard not to, but I'll try.
So, Aaron.
Yes.
Pasiti has been not with us for a while, and we welcome him back. He is a professor of economics at Siena College in Loudonville, New York, and we are thrilled that he is back with us, and from what I understand, will not be leaving anytime soon.
No.
That's good.
Sorry for my absence. It was travel, flu, and then scheduling issues.
Okay. Well, we're glad you're back.
Thank you.
And we're thrilled you're here.
Happy to be back.
Thank you very much. We are also thrilled to have Judith Enck with us. She joins us each and every Friday. If you check your calendars, today is a Friday. And God, doesn't it seem like it? Judith is here, and she is a former EPA administrator. We love having her on this program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Alan Chartok is with us as well. He is the guy. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hey!
How are you?
Somebody wrote me a letter and said, you sound so morose in the morning. So I was determined to do it differently this morning. Go, hey!
You succeeded. It was far from morose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I am really happy because the money is coming pouring in, Joe.
Did you see that new total there?
No, I
buddy?
Didn't. Yeah, well, tell me what it is.
I'll whisper in your ear. It's $892,000.
Wow. Well, so if by the end of this program today, we could have, you know, we could easily do $1 million, couldn't we? At the $1 million point?
I think we could if we established a WAMC swear jar.
White
House swear jar.
Right.
That would be a great.
Every time the occupant of the White House swore, another $10 in the jar.
Yeah, in fact, even if we just watched cable news, every time you hear it, just put $10 in the jar, you'd be done. So that's a lot of money. And so we're getting close. Alan, talk about the goal. Talk about when all this starts. Put it in context for us, sir.
Thank you, sir. February 5th. Is the beginning of the fund drive, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, this will have been the first and probably only $2 million fund drive. And why? Because we need to. It's so simple. People ask, and I just want to explain it. You always have to have about 3 months operating, 4 months operating expenses in the bank in order to go forward in case something disastrous happens. Well, we spent a good deal of that extra money that we had, that layover money, to make sure that we could buy the tower, and we bought the tower. And now we have to put that money back in the piggy bank. Otherwise, if a disaster happens, we're in bad trouble. So we're doing two things. We're raising money for the tower, and we are doing the regular three fund drives a year. This will be one. Who are the best people in the world? The people who listen to this radio station, who have put almost $900,000 in a couple of weeks because they understand this all so well. And how many ways can we count that we love them and that we are all in this together? I don't even begin to know. I'm not much of a mathematician, but I can tell you this is terrific. This is just terrific.
It really is. And what we want you to know is that so the goal for the lockbox is $1.5 million. Now,
right.
We're coming up on $1 million already. So that's the great news. The only part about this is concerning, there's the other $1 million.
No, the other $500,000, which we need. need so that we can go in with a $500,000 fund drive, which, by the way, the last three fund drives has ended in a day or a day and a couple of hours.
That's right. So we have a special event, and everyone in this room is going to be a part of that special event. So we're thrilled, and a lot of other people. So let me just talk about it for a second, and then we'll get into the... I'm putting off like this horrible story as long as I possibly can. Okay, so WAMC is hosting a live two-hour broadcast of the Roundtable a week from today. A week from today marks the one-year anniversary of the Trump administration. That, of course, happened on January 20th. We are going to meet on the 19th at the Linda on Friday. From 9 to 11, we'll have a live program. The doors open at 8:15. We're going to have a beautiful breakfast buffet for everybody. We're all the panel all-stars are going to be there. Now, if you don't hear a name that is your favorite, it's they were invited. They just can't come. So just so you know that. But
they're skipping the breakfast buffet?
Right. And so the breakfast buffet is going on. We are thrilled.
Pig in a blanket.
That's right. Pig in a blanket. We're going to have it's confirmed, Alan. We talked about it yesterday. It's confirmed. They've been ordered. So that's great.
Oh, no.
So David Soares is going to be with us. Jen Smith is going to be with us. J.P. Miller is going to be with us. Chris Churchill, Teresa Bourgeois, Joe Bonilla, and the folks in this room, Rich Honan, Aaron Pasitti, Judith Henk, and Alan Chartok. Alan and I will host, and it'll be a lot of fun. So we're going to be talking about the Trump administration. We have an economist. We have a climate expert. We have a corporate lawyer. We have all kinds of... What are you laughing about?
I was wondering what you were going to say when you were pointing to me. I thought you were going to say token conservative.
No, well, that too.
That too.
And we're going to, so all of these folks are going to come together. We're going to talk. And we're not going to be taking questions from we're not going to be taking letters. The only questions we'll be taking are from the floor, from the audience. And I'll be running around with a microphone. And we'll have plenty of time for your questions. And it's really going to be a great time. So please come in and join us. We have about 80 tickets left. So we started with 200. We're down to 80. Now, which oddly enough is the same number of people who are going to be on stage. But it's 80, it's 80 people that we have left. So if you want to be in on the 80, then you got to do it right now. It's $100 a ticket. It's a great time. You come over to the Linda. We have lots of parking over there. It's easy. You park. You go in. You have breakfast. You're amongst friends. And we're going to have a great time. So we talk, we take selfies. Rich, you've been a part of it. They're fun, aren't they?
I've been a part of it, yes.
Yeah, and you like it. Yeah,
people are very polite, yes.
You're coming back, so that's good.
I didn't know it was 2 hours, though.
Oh,
so
well,
I'll be back for some portion of it, probably around the buffet time.
Maybe you should charge billable hours for the extra time.
I always am anyway.
I'm sure that happens. Anyway, we want you to be a part of it. It's WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. Anything I forgot, Alan?
Nothing that I can absolutely think of at this time, Joe, except that those tickets are going fast. This is the second day we were offering them or the third morning we're offering them. And when they're gone, they're gone. And there won't be any more.
That's right.
Everybody know that. I'm saying that now. Don't be calling us up.
There's just so many people that you can get into that room. And
yep.
So we have about 80 tickets left. That was as of me walking into the studio. So whatever you want to do, let's do it now. And just a quick thing, if we got those tickets and we did that, we would have the money that would bring us up to $900,000. Just saying. Mm. We could do that within the next 15, 20 minutes. So there you go. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. WAMC.org, and you can go on our pull-down menu online and get your ticket there as well. All right. And all of the money from this event obviously goes to the Mount Greylock and the Fun Drive lockbox, just so you know. Okay. Let us talk about news of the day. So yesterday, apparently, the President of the United States was having a meeting in regards to immigration and talking about DACA, which is an issue, obviously, that we have been talking about quite a bit on this program, as the nation has been talking about it over the past several days. President Trump on Thursday balked at an immigration deal that would include protections for people from Haiti and some nations in Africa. demanding to know at a White House meeting why he should accept immigrants from a, quote, and I will clean this up, blank hole countries, rather than from places like Norway, according to people with direct knowledge of the conversation.
And by the way, who from Norway would want to come?
That's what I thought. You know, they've got universal health care and affordable higher education.
Sorry, Joe.
Isn't this the most heavily emigrated country in the world?
The U.S.?
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Trump's remarks, the latest example of his penchant for racially tinged remarks. I don't know. Tinge seems to be a little bit...
generous.
It's just a racist remark.
Denigrating immigrants left members of Congress from both parties attending the meeting in the Cabinet room alarmed and mystified. However, none of them have actually come forward and said that he said it, which is interesting. Also, as of, 15, 20 minutes ago, before I came into the studio, I don't believe Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell have commented on this at all.
Right.
Which I think is also interesting. Alan, I heard your comments earlier on this. I'm interested in what you make of all of it.
Well, first of all, the reason we don't use the excretory remark is because it's on the list. And now it's interesting. Donald Trump is denying he said it, as you make out. So as a result of that, if he has his FCC and others come along and say, you said the word on the radio in your radio station, so we're going to lift your license. I can't allow that to happen. So we say S-hole. That's what we say.
I think you should say blank hole.
Yeah.
And well, you know why?
Why?
Because when you say it, and it's not you, but I've heard it several times this morning, when you hear people say S-hole, it sounds like another bad word.
Oh, with an A.
Yeah.
That's interesting. But we could prove it. The point is, everybody knows what we're talking about.
Absolutely, that's
right. Let's move this part along. We get it.
Blank hole.
Yeah, but I just want everybody to know why we're doing what we're doing. And I have to say, now Trump has come along. He now denies he said it. He now denies he said anything bad about Haitians. He has the nerve to sign a Martin Luther King declaration this morning. What a hypocrite. It's just unbelievable.
Well, also, and just to add to the hypocrisy of all of this, especially in the remarks about Haiti, on the 8th anniversary today, marking the 8th anniversary of the devastating earthquake that leveled that country, and to put this on top of it just seems to be especially tone deaf.
200,000 to 300,000 people died in that earthquake, and that's why so many Haitians are in this country. You know, they're doctors, they're professors, they're also low-wage earners. And, you know, when I first heard the news report on this yesterday, the first thing I thought of was Michelle Obama's quote, being president doesn't change who you are, it reveals who you are.
Interesting.
And I think that this, whether he said these exact words or not, it fits a pattern. You know, you remember when President Trump announced his candidacy, he came down the escalator and attacked Mexicans. He has had choice words to say about Haitians in the past.
Well, just the aides and going back to their huts comments from the New York Times
2 weeks ago.
Over the holiday. So, I mean, this certainly fits a pattern. I just want to say, you know, even though he's denying the remarks, this has been verified by virtually every news organization in this country. The New York Times, The Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, NBC, CBS, ABC have all independently verified that this was said. Now, whatever the president says, okay, but still, from the people who were at the meeting, which was, I think I saw the number, was 18 or something?
Only one Democrat, Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, and his staff were in the room. The rest were Republicans. I mean, the meeting itself is interesting. Durbin and Lindsey Graham thought they were going to a meeting just with the president to have a serious discussion about the Dreamers. And they were met by really hard line anti-immigrant Congress members. Surprise, they're in the room. So my guess is the meeting went off the rails pretty early. We shouldn't lose fact of, you know, what does this mean for the Dreamer issue, the DACA renewal issue? But this also, you know, it just, you have to wonder, what does he say when there's not a group of Congress members in the room with him? What does he say when it's just his White House staff?
Well, and does that matter as much as the overall feeling that he has towards these people in this country? Again, I don't think it's anything all that surprising to people who have watched this White House and have seen him even as a candidate of bringing this up. A lot of it was perhaps nuanced, but this certainly is much more blatant. My question is, and just about the minute that we have left, is that once you have this cat out of the bag, to your point, yeah, then how do you move on to have any meaningful discussion?
And does he want any meaningful discussion? I mean, he said the other day, as soon as the Congress comes up with something, I'll sign mm-hmm. it. Well, he didn't mean it. He didn't mean it at all. As soon as they came up with something, he said, I don't like that.
Aaron.
Do I have more than a minute?
No.
Okay.
But you will if you want to defer to Rich.
Can I defer to Rich?
And then I'll come back after break. So now you have 20 seconds. No, go ahead.
I think just on the last point, I think he does. I think he is serious about if Congress does bring him something. He'll sign it, but Congress hasn't brought him anything, and this so-called Gang of Six brought is not acceptable to anybody.
All right, so we'll hold there. We'll start on this when we come back. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Rich Onan, and Aaron Pasitti. Aaron, guess what? I found your minute.
Okay.
Take it, sir.
So there's a hypocrisy, but I actually think it's an ignorance here about Trump's immigration policy, because one of his big campaign platforms was 4% GDP growth, that we're going to boost jobs, we're going to boost the economy. And he seems to be entirely ignorant of the two biggest headwinds the U.S. economy faces in boosting long-term GDP growth. One is declining labor force participation because of the retiring of the baby boomers. We had this population surge, which meant more workers from the 60s, and then that's starting to peter off in the 2000s. So a shortfall of domestic workers is the big is one of the big problems facing the U.S. And the second is the slowdown in productivity growth, meaning output per worker, how innovative workers are, how much they can produce. So declining labor force participation and declining productivity growth are the two things that are keeping economic growth down, not just in the short term, but for decades to come. So a lot of issues in economics are contentious, whether it's the minimum wage or the effect of entitlement programs. But there's one area where all economists, conservative or liberal, agree, and that is immigration is a net plus for the economy. It adds to GDP. Immigration creates more jobs than it takes. It increases the diversity of businesses. It increases worker specialization. It increases innovation and productivity. It has a negative effect on the national deficit. Immigration is a net positive to the economy. And when the U.S. economy is facing a shortfall of workers, either we replace them with robots or we can replace them with immigrant workers. So, since 1970, immigration as a share of the U.S. population has gone up from 5% to 13%. And even that hasn't been enough to increase GDP growth. So if Trump wants to boost economic growth, turning to immigrants, whether they're low skilled or medium skilled or high skilled, the point is that they all come to the country, they start more businesses than they destroy, they create more jobs than they take. They have a long-term effect, a long-term positive effect on wages. And he just seems to be ignorant that, independent of the country of origin, immigration is a net plus for the economy. And that's exactly what we need. Mm-hmm.
But that's first of all, it's balanced on the backs of those illegal immigrants, because they're being paid well under any wages.
Not necessarily
and well under
illegal.
Benefits. And it only works because of the entitlement system that we have set up structurally in this country. If we
they're not all
have
illegal
that,
immigrants. There's plenty
if,
of – we're talking mostly about legal immigrants.
If you're not a documented legal immigrant, well,
I'm not counting
so-called entitlement programs.
But Judith, I'm not counting legal immigrants in the conversation. Legal immigrants are part of the country.
But
are you saying illegal immigration is a net
sure.
driver?
Because they pay. I mean,
right.
so I mean,
that's what
they
I
pay taxes, but they're not entitled to take advantage of government-sponsored programs.
Alan, you want it in? Yeah.
No, we got an interesting note on the back of Aaron's very interesting, laying it all out, the problem, from Wanda, who said that, and I hope Wanda is right about this, but who said that Trump employs Haitians at Mar-a-Lago.
Yes. That was reported yesterday. It's almost half of the workforce at Mar-a-Lago. You know, I think one of the great narratives on this to support Aaron's perspective, about a week ago, Tom Brokaw had a wonderful op-ed in the New York Times talking about American hospitals and how you meet people from all different countries, from the person who wheels you out in the wheelchair to your surgeon to your specialist. I recommend going back and reading that. I think it's a nice tonic to what we've been subjected to in the last 24 hours.
So when you look at this, Alan, as far as the silence by the Republicans and in terms of getting a deal done, when assuming these statements are true, and the again, it has been reported by just about everybody and confirmed from the people, the many people that were in the meeting. So what do they just stay quiet about it? And is that the best strategy here, or do they eventually have to come out and say this isn't acceptable?
Well, if you're asking me, Joe, if it's the best strategy, it is not the best strategy, as Mrs. Wick once said in eighth grade, to stay shut. But they do it because they're between that rock and a hard place, which we've talked about so many times, of having to face a right-wing primary opponent who outdoes them. And they want to stay senator, or they want to stay congressman, and they're not doing the right thing. So is it from their personal, selfish perspective the thing to do? That's what they're doing. Is it the right thing for this country, which they say they owe their patriotism to? No.
But does anybody think there's not going to be a DACA deal eventually?
I don't know if there's going to be a good DACA deal. I mean, I think they won't do a what they call a standalone clean bill. That's what's needed here. You don't want to be playing politics with the lives of 800,000 young people. But I think to build on what Alan just said, it's Republicans are worried about their political survival, but also I think a lot of Republicans are quiet at moments that you need to hear their voices because they are interested in Trump making more judicial appointments. They like Trump pulling apart regulatory agencies like the EPA or consumer protections. But I think this is a real gut check moment for Republicans. I would like to think that most Republicans don't share this perspective, but if they don't speak out, they don't get the benefit of the doubt. I don't think we're going to hear from McConnell and Paul Ryan for a number of reasons. I want to know, where is John Faso on this? Where is Elise Stefanik? Why have they not made a public statement and disowned their association with this president on this important issue?
We should note that many, many both those in Congress and Senate have, both Republican and Democrat. So
very few Republicans have spoken out. Mia Love, but whose parents
Haitian,
are from Haiti,
right.
Haitian, she's Haitian American, she's a Republican. Orrin Hatch says he wants more information. All the Republicans I've heard in the last 12 hours have not been disavowing this.
But don't
I heard the word unfortunate a lot.
Yeah, isn't it more important to see if, I mean, yes, that's important, but isn't it more important to see if there's a deal to be done? Isn't the result more important than the process?
Yes, well, and no. Getting the DACA deal is crucial, but where this president is bringing this country in
right.
terms of our moral standing and our international status is very, very important.
Wait, this president is the one trying to actually do a DACA deal legislatively, which no one has tried to do before, and people have tried to do in ways that were found to be unconstitutional. He's taking on, you might not like where he stands on it, but he's having the conversation that other people did not have the ability to have.
How in the hell do you know that? You say he's trying to have a, Rich, come on. You say he's trying to have a legislative deal. And yet when the Gang of Six, who you say nobody believes or nobody agrees with, comes up with a deal, a bipartisan deal, he wants nothing to do with it. You know, I think he wants his cake and eat it. And while I have the mic for 1 second, I want to say something else. and that is that even when this president says really despicable things about the grabbing of genitals or, you know, somebody else is sleeping with somebody else's wife or doing this or that, you know what happens? Everybody, including his own wife, says, oh, you shouldn't have said that. And then everybody goes on. That's the end of it.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, to me, this is so, you know, in terms of the Republican silence on this, you could just throw a dart at any labor economist and bring them in to testify before Congress, and they'll say the same thing, that immigration is a net plus for the economy. And I don't see why Republicans aren't getting behind that as a – I'm not saying that we can't have more sensible immigration policy, especially with regard to you know, undocumented immigrants. But there are ways to do this that could be an even bigger gain for the economy. And I'm just surprised that Republicans aren't leveraging this, because there's just unanimity amongst economists in how they view this. And it's turning into a straight up racist debate at this point. And I think that the racist nature of the president and some congressmen and their supporters is outweighing the positive economic effects this could have on the country for the next few decades.
I just want to quickly say something that I thought was really interesting, which was, now I realize this is a little bit skewed by just the outlet that it was on, but I was watching C-SPAN yesterday, and they have the open phones, and they have the Republican phones, and they have the Democratic phones. And the question inevitably came up of, will this, you know, will these comments that the president make, you know, somebody said, well, they go directly to his base. And the Republican line went nuts with people who say, I consider myself mm-hmm. part of the base, mm-hmm. but I don't want to be associated right. with these comments. Right. And I thought it was really interesting. And they said, you know, and if this is the tenor of the comments to come, I will reconsider, because I find mm-hmm. them that concerning.
Mm. I'm curious where the Christian evangelicals are who saw so enthusiastically supported Trump. Do they, you know, does that part of the faith community endorse this? And if they don't, they need to speak out quick.
Well, I don't mean to be cynical or flip, but they didn't seem to have a problem with a pedophile running in
that is true.
In Alabama. So
that
I don't know if being racist against Haitians or the comments about Charlottesville, right.
But there are a lot of evangelical congregations that do a lot of social services work with immigrants. I mean, look, I'm enormously disappointed how you can be an evangelical Christian and, you know, deal with the Access Hollywood tape and deal with the pedophile who was running for office. But maybe, just maybe, this will be a turning point for that community.
But
stop
been
laughing.
But there have been turning points. I mean, everything over the past year, people are like, well, this could be a turning point, and it's clearly not been a turning point.
So Judith just pointed to the television set, and so Senator Dick Durbin, who was at that meeting, again, Alan alluded earlier that the president
yep.
tweeted out that he did not use this language. Senator Durbin said Trump used those words. And again, it was, as I said, it's been widely reported and verified by many, both Republican and Democrats that were in the room, that they were used.
Now it's worse. Trump's lied about it now.
Right.
For a change.
Imagine that.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more, and we have a couple of your letters, too. So all of that and much more coming up after this. Oh, I love when you kids argue economics. It's so much fun to watch.
All right, we're going to start arguing credit default swaps pretty soon.
Wow. That was in
the
weeds.
Don't go there.
Boy, the gloves were
CDO
off.
CDO squared. Yeah, here we go.
Judith and I were just staring at you guys going off on that. All right,
don't
make
me go into the Phillips curve.
Good morning. Welcome back.
I know
you
did.
To the roundtable. It's very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok is here. Judith Egg, Aaron Pacitti, and you're still here, Rich. Good morning. Rich Onan is still here.
Note to listeners, Rich sits near the door.
Yeah, just in case he and during the breaks he stands up, so he's always ready
to
bolt.
I'm always ready.
Yep.
He's also got a bulletproof vest on.
But other than that, he's a great guy.
By the way, come meet him next week. Come on out next Friday. We'll all be there. WAMC.org to find out more information. Okay, a couple of letters. Let's go to Roger, who says Republican leadership must firmly condemn these insulting and racist remarks on blank hole nations, as quoted on the BBC and by the New York Times, is outrageous. It's just the latest and perhaps worst of a series of often far too personal attacks on individuals and multiple ethnic groups. Republicans in Congress, it's time to put duty to country above party. Live up to your constitutional responsibilities and remove this man from the office of presidency. Kim says, of course he's denying having said it. All I can come up with is two unnamed sources familiar with the conversation. If he is denying it, what solid evidence is there to support that he did? Well, we just found
out that
Dick Durbin, who was in the meeting and was really the reason the meeting was taking place with Lindsey Graham, correct, said that it happened. Ramon writes, Trump's despicable comment is sadly typical fare from the political elite, definitely more vulgarly expressed, but the same as Obama's flyover country and Hillary's basket of deplorables. The political class sees the common people as others and not the same as their elite form of human being. Particularly infuriating is his prior talk at the Haitian community, which has now proved to be typical self-serving, duplicitous words of sweetness that all politicians use when seeking votes. It is no wonder why state capitals in D.C. were the lowest of the low. It is enough to make anyone's blood boil.
I take great exception to that because what again, it's another example. I know Ramon feels well, and he writes to us a lot. Feels good about this, but is committed to it. But you know, it is another example of false equivalency. Not all of these things are the same. When a president of the United States uses the S-hole,
Blank hole.
Well, you can say whatever you want. We all know what he did. When he uses that, it's a terrible thing. To say that's the same as when a president flies over an affected area is just ridiculous. Take it back.
So, Alan, it's okay with you if a president says a bad thing about their country, but if they say a bad thing about people in another country, that's worse for you?
I'm sorry. That needs a little clarification, Rich.
Hillary called American voters deplorables. Obama referred to states as flyover states and talked about people clinging to their guns and religion. So they were taking shots at Americans. Trump, in a far more vulgarly way, I admit, takes shots at non-Americans, that's more offensive to you?
Well,
you don't see that as equivalent?
Well, if you're going to just stop putting words in my mouth for a minute, I might answer you. And that is, I do believe that Hillary made a mistake when she said basket of deplorables. It was a political mistake, if not a senseless mistake. But, you know, it is not the same thing as when a president of the United States uses that whatever word you want to use, blank or S-hole or whatever. And come on, Rich, you know better than that.
I mean, Obama was somewhat guilty of that when he referred to Wall Street bankers and CEOs as being fat cats. That wasn't nearly as egregious. I'm just saying, like,
I think they like the fat cat title. You cannot compare.
I mean, they probably patted themselves on the back
to what Trump has said about a large part of the world.
The larger point is that presidents can slip up when they're under the microscope like that.
But they're not the same.
No, I understand that.
That's the same.
That's where I'm going with this: is that the level of degradation is substantially higher here, and it's clearly hiding some fairly ugly personality traits and views on social policy.
As did the deplorables remark.
The deplorables remark
was certainly speaking, and I'm not. I agree with Alan and what he said about it, but it was referring to a portion of the base of Donald Trump, which, let's face it, the White House was admitting last night that this was going to work very well with those people that he was talking about who are racist.
I would like to go on the record by saying some Trump voters who are happy about what Trump said last night are deplorable. They are racist. Many are sexist. Many don't work for economic justice. And while it was not wise for Hillary Clinton in a campaign and with her stature to say basket of deplorables, the policy that they represent, the view that they represent, indeed, I think we all can agree racism is deplorable.
Well, yes. Yeah, we agree on that.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't make the referential leap that you guys make from him making the remark to racism. I agree.
How can you not?
What?
When you look at his whole, look at his announcement and what he, you know, the day
the
he announced
ban
his,
and...
his presidency, look,
the
what he said about Mexico.
The
and what
issue,
he said about the folks in the park, which turned out to be not true. Or what he said about Obama's citizenship and where he was born. Come on, the guy's a racist.
He did suggest for years that Obama was from Africa, which I think Trump knows nothing about. I bet he doesn't know Africa is 54 different countries. And I think the bigger issue here is, what does Trump's worldview mean in terms of his policy development? I firmly believe that the response to the hurricanes in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, if you compare it to the response in Florida and Texas, has something to do with Trump's worldview.
And Rich, do you feel that this hurts us in the on the world stage?
No.
Really? Absolutely. You don't think people look at this and see it? I mean, you hear it in the BBC broadcast, you hear it in looking at the headlines around the world of how this is being perceived. You don't think that that hurts us as a nation?
Let me be clear. I don't like it any more than anybody else when he acts as unpresidential as he does. All right, the vulgarity, the boorishness, the rudeness, the everything. All right, for a million reasons I don't like it. Mainly because one, it's not presidential, but two, it to me it gets in the way of his agenda, and that's an agenda with which I agree. You know, as opposed to you guys don't agree with his agenda, but I think we all agree that it doesn't seem to advance the ball. But no, I think results matter. And I think if we're going to get a deal on immigration, I think that deal is going to involve some, I'm not going to call it comprehensive immigration reform, right? Because that's that was always the mantra. But I think that deal is going to involve some DACA relief. I think it's going to involve enhanced security, as it should. I think it's going to probably involve some restrictions on these things like chain migration and things like that. And what he was talking about in the most vulgar of ways was something that really goes to the heart of our immigration policy, which is, is immigration something to basically provide relief for people who are in bad circumstances,
like earthquakes?
Correct. or is immigration something meant to that needs to be more of a direct benefit to the country? Now, you would say, I think that's a fair, now that's a very dicey question, but I think that's a fair issue to talk about. What is the role of immigration?
And it flies in the face of our nation's history.
I don't think so, Judith.
I think a lot of people from Europe, our parents and our grandparents came to this country because they wanted a better economic condition. And maybe they didn't show up with graduate degrees, and maybe they weren't from Norway or Asia, but they came to this country, they were welcomed, and they enhanced the social fabric of our society. Why block that? Why say you only want white, high-earner immigrants? That's what Trump said, you said. What Trump said.
The circumstances between when my family came and what is going on right now are really different. And one of them is, first of all, those people came legally. Second, those people were filling jobs that were needed. We were building out the infrastructure of the country. All right. Now, and Aaron, I know, we can talk about, the benefits of illegal immigration. But the question is, at the time, if you said, what does the country need in 1910? And the answer was, we need 100, we need we need 20 million people who are going to work for a dollar an hour and do railroads or something like that. And that's what they got. I think it's fair to ask the question, what does the country need in 2017? And then we have to be prepared for what that answer is.
More workers.
And it's different from every country.
I mean, more untrained workers who are unable to support themselves in an economic way? Are you talking more H-1B type workers?
Just immigrant workers can acquire skills one way or the other, whether it's through on-the-job performance or by
picking crops.
Community colleges. Not even picking crops. It's just that the biggest challenge facing the U.S. economy for the next half century is a declining labor force. So either we subsidize childbirth, which I haven't heard anybody suggest as a possible solution, or we can accept more immigration to just fill the demographic bubble popping.
But Aaron, until we fix the immigration system, though, those people have to be, people have to be brought in and processed and made part of the system.
I agree.
So they can be educated, and they can be trained, and everything like that. And that's what we're trying to do now.
So that's part of sensible immigration reform. Right,
oh, that's part of it.
Okay,
you know what I'm hearing from Rich? I'm hearing pull up the gangplank. I'm here.
Before we go to the news, which I want to, which we have to do because,
it's not going to be good
waiting.
News.
No. here are the comments that Dick Durbin made just a few moments ago to reporters. In the course of his comments, President Trump said things that were hate-filled, vile, and racist. I cannot believe in this history of the White House and that Oval Office, any president has ever spoken the words I personally heard our president speak yesterday, saying that his denials are not true and that he spoke those words.
Thank you, Dick Durbin.
He obviously has not read Doris Kearns Goodwin.
We will be back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning. We're having a robust discussion. Alan Chartok is here, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and Rich Honan. I was just talking to our IT department in the hall just before I came back on the air, and they said, our email server is working overtime. And I said, why? I wonder why. And they said, well, I don't know, but we got a lot of letters for Rich. So I'm going to go to him. Are you ready? Are you ready, buddy?
Diversity is good for ratings.
Yeah, that's right.
Here we go. All right. Justin says, to Rich's point about undocumented immigrants not being as good for the country as documented, I would say make it easier to migrate legally. Illegal immigrants can't be paid exploitive wages if they aren't illegal anymore. And job market's now filled with undocumented people will have to pay the competitive and legal wages to their workers regardless of immigration status.
Justin, not only we all agreed to that over the break.
Yeah.
So
I will attest to that. Yes.
Okay. Ellen says, thanks to Rich for his comments on immigration. And to add a thought, the more people who get to work as documented immigrant workers instead of the illegal status they have today, that would help save Social Security by adding to the number of people paying into the program. The people who say Social Security is in trouble point to less workers paying into the system, undermining the long-term stability of the program. Yes, immigrants are important to the long-term health of our economy. Dave says, anyone can rip up DACA or regulations. It is bringing together a consensus and passing legislation that fixes issues that defines a leader.
True. And in fact, a federal judge ruled a few days ago that what Trump is doing on DACA is illegal.
I got to say, I didn't understand that because originally Obama took executive action on DACA, and it was ruled unconstitutional.
Because he couldn't get it through Congress.
Right. And then Trump basically said, all right, we're going to undo the executive action that was held unconstitutional, and that itself was held unconstitutional. I'm confused on that one.
Okay.
But it does say a lot about Congress that during the Obama administration, Obama did try very hard to get a bill through Congress. Congress wouldn't do it, and so Obama did executive action.
And I think that's I agree with you, Judith, and I think that's the answer, that's some of the answer for the deafening silence from Republicans. One is, look, what can you possibly say, right? He says something else and it blows over. But the other thing is, unless the press is pointing at the president and the people are pointing at the president, somebody's going to be pointing at Congress. And it's Congress that has dropped the ball for the last however many administrations.
Anne writes, Rich is rewriting history. The McConnell-led Congress actively and repeatedly demonstrated complete unwillingness to work with Obama on anything. Yep. Claiming that Trump is the first to work on legislative solution is disingenuous at best. We get this from Tony, who says, starts it off this way, dearest Rich. How far would you let Trump go to see your agenda accomplished? Lies and racism aren't enough for you, so what's your line in the sand?
Listen, I already turned against him on the tax bill that raised my taxes by $30,000. Okay, so I'm not digging everything that he does.
Whoa, you make a lot of money.
Thomas says, Rich, please stop muddying the waters with false equivalencies. The difference between blank hole and deplorables is that nobody chooses which country they're born in, but every Nazi made a conscious choice to be a Nazi.
Joe, can I just check in here? We've gotten three letters, or which took me to great task for my insistence that we not use the S-hole word. Now, the reason I did it, I explained earlier. I want to explain it again.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, very quickly. The reason I did it was that NPR isn't a station. They don't own any stations. They can't hear Trump. Can come after a WAMC or anybody else and hold you up for a long time on license renewals and everything else. So that's why. And they say, well, people do have a right to know that he said the S word. Everybody knows he said the S word. Come on. That's all I got to say about that.
All right. Now, here's someone who agrees with you, War, who says, I agree with Alan as usual. The difference between Obama's flyover country and Clinton's basket of deplorables, which, by the way, also made me think of a basket of kittens, and Trump's verbal filth is vast. Anyone can make a mistake once, but he has showed his racist sentiments many, many, many times before and after the election. Nancy says the difference between these remarks and other remarks by presidents and other political figures is that these racist comments are followed up by overtly racist policies. Are we going to ignore that these comments that have been made since the start of Trump's campaign and his actions and comments throughout his life are leaning towards policies that are about ethnic and racial cleansing? Obama and Clinton, says Ed, slipped up on some of their comments. Trump's comments are not a slip. They are consistent with many, many such statements he has made, continues to make, and likely will make again. Not a slip. It's how he thinks. It's how he feels. Timothy says, GOP tax plan is pro-automation regarding immigrant labor and GDP. Remember, GOP tax plan favors automation over hiring. And we have the letter from Mark saying, my only comment, I've been a registered Democrat all my life, but do not vote strictly on party lines. I do not agree with, but respect Trump's base and their conservative Republican views. And I wholeheartedly support their rights to express their views and choose their representative by exercising their right to vote. But this Trump is not the man to represent them or this country. He has to go.
Can we go back to the automation?
Yes, from Tim and Utica.
That's an interesting take, and I'm looking at Aaron because this is his bailiwick. Interesting take that the tax plan kind of promotes automation. The thing that first came to mind for me was the reduced tax rate for people who own businesses does not apply to law firms or accountants or consultants, mm-hmm. but it would apply to people who own like a machine shop or something like that.
There was the immediate deduction of investment expenses instead of spreading that out.
Right, and so then the 5-year
capital investment.
Yeah. Interesting. I'd never heard that take before that it was meant to and if indeed it is meant to achieve automation. Then that really underlines what Aaron said before, in that it's going to have a really deleterious effect on GDP growth because it's going to reduce productivity. Well, it's going to actually increase productivity.
It'll increase productivity, but decrease employment, yeah. And then you get...
Well, and it's not new. I mean, look at something as simple as when you go to the bank and you go to the ATM rather than the teller. And in the coal industry, this whole... upsetment about losing coal industry jobs because you have concern about climate change. What's losing jobs in the coal industry is certainly it's a dirty, unsustainable fuel, but also the whole industry has been automated. So you've got mountaintop mining, for instance, in Appalachia, where they blow up literally with dynamite the top of the mountain, destroying the ecology of that region, damaging public health. And that's their technology of choice as opposed to old-fashioned coal miners. That's big reason why coal jobs are down.
And there's the competition from the natural gas extraction through fracking. Environmental impacts aside, that's a major, major cost savings in terms of using fossil fuels to generate electricity.
Which, by the way, just as an aside for local listeners, Governor Cuomo wants to bring fracked gas from Pennsylvania and use it in the Sheridan Avenue facility to create a microturbine rather than geothermal and solar and clean renewables right in the Arbor Hill section of Albany. That's another show.
There's a big not in my backyard part to renewables, isn't there? Where somebody, everybody says, or to energy in general, actually. People say, I don't want the energy. I want to use the energy. I just don't want it created here unless it's created in some kind of clean way.
I don't see the intensity of opposition to solar and wind than you see, for instance, to fracked gas or coal or oil. I was just in the Finger Lakes on Sunday where there's a new proposed giant garbage incinerator. And would be the largest in the state. Lucky for us, there's also a proposal to do a giant solar facility. And to your point, Rich, some people were expressing concerns about that. They wanted to do a six-year moratorium. I stood up and said, are you kidding me? We need big solar. We need small solar. That's a good alternative. So I was surprised that there was some opposition there, but I think you can talk to people and bring them around that there's a vast difference between a big solar installation and a garbage incinerator, for instance, the Finger Lakes.
Can I ask? I'm sorry, I don't want to get us off. Can I take a 30-second question?
Yes, then we have to move on to other topics. Okay, we're going to go into a lightning round.
So we're talking about the this idea of mountaintop mining, which is just incredibly backwards, right?
It seems deplorable.
It blows up. It is, and it turns the mountain into a blank hole. But I wonder if the economics you wonder if people thought there was more of a future to coal, that where might there be more technology based on that? But right now, no one's going to spend time doing R&D on coal if there's not going to be any coal in 10 years.
You
wonder about the unintended consequences.
Well, for 25 years, the Department of Energy and others have been pushing so-called clean coal and carbon sequestration, where you try to capture the carbon emissions and inject it underground. A lot of money has gone into that. Not as much lately, because I think economists in Wall Street realize the American coal industry is pretty much dead no matter what Scott Pruitt and God help us, Rick Perry are saying.
So you're not going to see technological advances.
I don't think you're going to see private money invested
in
that.
Right, good point.
But you may still see.
Look where the big investment banks and hedge funds and private equity funds are putting their money in terms of energy generation.
Well, they're putting it
into
solar.
Fuel cells, geothermal. And the sad thing in Albany is Governor Cuomo said he supports divestment of fossil fuels for pensions, state pensions here. And yet he's providing over $80 million to the New York Power Authority to use fracked gas in downtown Albany. That doesn't seem like a good divestment strategy to me.
Sorry, Joe. Didn't mean to.
No, that's all right. You're fine.
I had an expert here, so
I'm
figured
glad you're here.
Ask.
I'm glad you're here. So let's talk about offshore drilling. This has been a story of the week. The decision to exempt Florida from offshore drilling prompts bipartisan uproar. The Trump administration's decision to exempt Florida from expanded offshore drilling kicked off a frenzy this week in other coastal states, with governors from both political parties asking, hey, why not us? We cannot afford to take a chance with the beauty, the majesty, and the economic value and vitality of our wonderful coastline, according to South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster, a Republican who backed Trump in his state's competitive 2016 primary. He said in a statement, not off our coast, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper wrote in a tweet. We've been clear this would bring unacceptable risks to our economy, our environment, and our coastal communities. The Florida carve-out announced Tuesday by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke created new doubts about the fate of the entire offshore drilling decision and immediately became another challenge for Republicans as they work to hold off Democrats in the midterm elections. Judah, think.
So this is good on three counts. First, I don't want to see offshore drilling in Florida. This is good for Florida. Second, it's less oil to be burned and contributing to the climate crisis. And third, I think we all should send flowers to Ryan Zinke because he has really screwed up his ability in court to defend offshore drilling in other states. If it's not good enough for Florida, Why is it good enough for California and New Jersey and Oregon? And so I think state attorneys general across the country who've united in saying they're going to challenge this were handed a gift. Rich, I think you'd agree, this is the casebook definition of arbitrary and capricious, saying that Florida has a robust tourism industry, therefore we can't have it there. Well, right. What about the other tourist industries in other coastal communities? So I think this is a really great development.
Yeah, and I think I can't think of, it's hard for me to imagine any private company going out and drilling offshore of a state, knowing that the state government is against it, but you know, holding up that the feds, you know, allowed us to write.
They do it. Zinke advanced this policy at the request of the fossil fuel industry. They don't care about what North Carolina thinks or Oregon thinks. They want to drill. Domestic drilling is cheaper than, say, in the Arctic.
Sure.
And the Arctic is also opened up. I heard the governor of Oregon interviewed, just kind of from a democracy perspective. She said she's been calling Zinke consistently. He won't call her back. And yet the way Zinke describes how he got to this decision was a conversation with Senator Scott, a Republican of Florida. This is all fantastic for the legal challenges that are to come.
So outside of, you know, states like Nevada with Las Vegas and Hawaii, Florida has an exceptionally large tourism-driven economy. It's about 10% of all economic activity. And let's not forget where Mar-a-Lago is located either, that there's environmental risks to this. Getting back to the point of that, you know, Republicans have been saying, like, we need to deregulate, we need to open up offshore drilling, this is job creation. Well, if it's such a big job creator, then it's very difficult to see why Florida has been exempt from what Trump claims is a huge job creator for the state.
Or if not Florida. Or
wherever, yeah.
And the other thing is, you would think the reverse would be true. Okay, so maybe there would be some states that say, no, our tourism is more of a driver for us. But then you would think there would be some states, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the state, Alabama, or the states that have already have rigs offshore, and they say, you know what? It's already there. We'll add to it. We need the revenue.
Yeah.
You would think, from a capitalist way, that would happen.
Yeah. Another big part of the story is after the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, the federal government put some, I would argue, modest new protections in place to prevent these oil blowouts. And a dozen workers died in that disaster. About 3 weeks before Zinke's announcement on offshore drilling, they announced that they were relaxing those protections to better regulate offshore drilling. So this is the 1-2 punch. BP and Exxon and Chevron and ConocoPhillips all pushed hard to relax the environmental and marine protection controls around drilling, and then it's followed by this announcement.
I don't know why they're just not making states like Florida and Arizona just these giant solar farms.
Let me rephrase that.
I know why they're not doing it, but
Despite the Trump policies, it is happening. I mean, the largest wind producer is Texas and also, is it not Kansas?
Oklahoma.
I thought it was Nebraska. But.
No, it's
a Great Plains state.
It's a Great Plains state. But it is. It's in the middle of the country, and Texas are the big wind producers.
Yeah, and yet you'd be, you know, we do a lot of work with people who are trying to do work in wind. You'd be surprised, to your point before, Judith, how many people say, I don't want a 70-foot windmill, you know, on my land. Now, I'm not talking about in your backyard. Right. I'm talking about people who own, you know, lots of acreage and, you know, the Adirondack area.
Yeah.
They say, we don't want it.
Yeah, Alan, and we have to address that, because if you care about climate change, you've got to look at some wind turbines and some solar panels.
Or just go out and buy a Tesla.
Alan, there was a line in that article that I read about how this would affect the midterms. What do you think?
Oh, I think the Republicans are in terrible, terrible trouble, and they know it. And they go back and forth between having to watch Trump apply his messaging to the base. But it does look, from everywhere I'm sitting, I got a little bit of a pang the other day when I saw that Trump was trying to be presidential. And I'm saying, I wonder how many people he's going to fool. Well, it didn't last that long.
Yeah. 48 hours.
All right. We are out of time. Just a reminder that we have this event going on next week, a week from today. And
going like hotcakes.
It is. Yeah. We only have, I think, about 60 tickets left. So if you want in, this is the time to do it. They're going fast. They'll probably be gone by the end of the day. So if you want in, now do it now. And then, as Alan always says, you know, then don't come. What do you say, Alan?
Don't be calling. Don't be calling me.
There you go. I'll be calling you. So it is next Friday, the 19th, from 9 to 11. Doors will open at 8:15. There will be a mingle with all of the panel all-stars. Alan and I will host. Joe
and
Bonilla, Therese. You're going to host?
Hey, no, the all-stars and Rich.
And Rich, I got
you. You're an all-star.
Joe Bonilla, Teresa Bourgeois, Chris Churchill, Judith Eng, Rich Honan, J.P. Miller, Aaron Pacitti, Jen Smith, David Soares, all will be there with us, and we hope you will be too. Again, 8:15 for the breakfast. You'll mingle with the panel and WAMC members, then the actual panel, which will, of course, air live on the air, 9 to 11. And if you want to ask a question, that's where to go. And we'll be taking questions from the four that day. And we're going to be looking about, in totality, the 1-year anniversary of the Trump administration.
It's Iowa. Texas and Iowa are the biggest win producers.
The record is corrected. Please note that in the minutes. My thanks to all Alan, Judith, Aaron, and Rich. Rich, thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.